Good to be back with you tonight. Going back to Matthew, the 24th chapter. As we've been going through, trying to go through in a bit more of a detailed manner of this discourse on the Mount of Olives that Jesus has just before he is to be crucified, as he's talked about the unfruitfulness of the people, and he has shared seven woes of warning against the Jewish leaders and teachers, and he told them in the previous chapter, chapter 23, that all the righteous blood that's been shed upon the earth is going to come upon that generation. And in chapter 24, as they discussed the temple, and he said that not a single stone would be left that would not be thrown down, his apostles had asked him, when will these things be? And will there be a signs that will precede this situation? And so we have gone through and we've talked about these things, and this lesson is going to probably be a bit different than what we've been doing. We're definitely venturing out of the historical kind of ideas and different things we've talked about with the historian Josephus and things like that in the past. And now we're getting into a discussion, really, of this transition kind of text that I don't believe is a transition. I used to believe it was transition. I've told you that before. I don't believe it's transition anymore. And I'll show you why I don't believe that. And have you come to your own conclusion on the matter as you consider the evidence for yourself and see what bearing this has on our understanding of this these really great scriptures here on the Olivet Discourse, as well as our understanding of the Bible as a whole. So as we come now to Matthew 24, and verse 32 is where we had left off last time. Jesus said, "From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." All right, so when we look here, Jesus gives this little parable. All right, some of the translations say parable here, Matthew and Luke's account, Mark's account just as well. This parable, very short little parable of the fig tree. All right, now, one of the issues that has surfaced in latter years is individuals, people who follow a line of theory, a premillennialism, all right, have taken this text and they say that the fig tree in the parable represents the Jewish race, all right, and the reason why they're wanting to press that idea is so that this text could represent anything in time. All right, it doesn't have to be limited now to the first century. It could just be limited to the Jewish race. And so these things could be happening in our time. And a lot of people say the information in Matthew 24 is in fact happening in our time, or some of it will be happening in our future, or something like that. And so it's a tricky little thing to be able to transform this fig tree and to say that this tree is the family tree of the Jews. Now, if we look at the text, and you look at Luke's account of that, we show that Luke throws that idea right out the door. Luke 21, verse 29 is the parallel text where Jesus said he told them a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. All right? So, Jesus doesn't have one tree in mind, okay? Now, the fig tree was certainly something that they have been seeing. We know that just a day or two ago, he had cursed the fig tree that was fruitless and it withered away at its roots. And so there are certainly fig trees all around there. They're on the Mount of Olives. There's fig trees everywhere, of course. So, he tells them, look at the fig tree. Now just put yourself in this situation. They're not in a building like this. And Jesus says, let me take the example of the fig tree. No, I'm sure what he was doing was, look right here. Look at this fig tree. All right, that's probably what he was doing. But Luke points out, he says, look at the fig tree and all the trees. All right, we're not dealing with any particular people or any particular race of people. It's evident from Luke's account that Jesus, he's just talking about trees. And how did trees respond? When the branch becomes tender, it starts to put out those fresh, light green little leaves, okay, the teeny tiny leaves. Then he says, that is a sign that summer is near. How easy is that? What a simple parable that is. Of course, we see that even to this very day. Summer is near when the trees finally start to sprout some fresh green leaves again. Now notice that he even gives an interpretation. Okay, so he lets us know he's not talking about a race of people here. He's just talking about trees. And the sign that when you see the leaves growing in the spring, you know that summer's just around the corner. So in verse 33, he says, so also when you see all these things, you know that he is near. All right, so the point of the fig tree is not to illustrate the Jewish nation. The point of the fig tree is to illustrate that when you observe the fig tree and it sprouts new leaves, you know that summer is near. So he says, when you are observing the situation there in the first century, notice he's saying in verse 33 to his apostles, he says, when you, okay, he's not talking to us. How often we forget that when we open up the Bible and we start to make applications that maybe we ought not to be making. Here he is talking to a very specific group of people, these apostles on the Mount of Olives, and he says, when you see. All right, that means they would have had to have been around to see these things. And if we go back, if we were to read all through Matthew 24 again, we're not going to, but if we were, we would see this all over the place. When you see the abomination of desolation, all right? Or he tells them, you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. They will persecute you. He says, some of you will be killed. He's talking personally to his apostles and not to us. And so when he tells them here, when you see all these things, that it demands, the inference demands that they would be alive still to be able to see all these things. Not just a little bit, and not just some, all of it. All that's been spoken of in Matthew 24. So when you see these things, just like when you see the fig tree sprout new life, you know summer's coming. So when you see all these things I've been talking about, okay, with the abomination of desolation showing up and all that, and Jerusalem being laid siege for 5 months, all of this that he's been dealing with, that great 5 month tribulation there, when you see all these things, know that summer is near. All right. Well, it's not summer, of course, but that was the parable. But what he says is know that he is near. Now, who's he in the context? Well, remember what we dealt with last week, the coming of the Son of Man in judgment, in a regional, localized judgment against the Jewish people in the city of Jerusalem. All right, in verse 29 and 30 and 31, we discussed all these things, where you have the sign of the Son of Man appearing in heaven, all the tribes, okay, all the Jews mourning because of him. They'll see the one whom they pierced, and they'll see the sign of him coming on the clouds of heaven with great power and glory, the end of verse 30 said. Okay? You see that sign of him coming with great power and glory. And so when we get to this point here, when he says in verse 33, when you see all these things happening, then you know that he is near. The Son of Man, the judgment against the perverse house of Israel in the first generation. And then he says in verse 34, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. All right, so this has all been about that generation. We've seen a lot of fantastic things. He talked about the sun, you know, going dark, the moon turning into blood, you know, the stars falling from heaven. But we dealt with those things last week. We saw that God has always used that kind of language. It is iconic in the Bible. That's how God communicates judgments. That's how he communicates to people that he is turning the lights out on a nation. Okay, that nation is going dark. It is being destroyed. It's being judged and all of that. And so there's a lot of fantastic things, but he tells them, truly I say to you. Look at the emphasis there. All right? Everything I've said to you, and I'm sure for the apostles just like us, it really does sound quite fantastic. How could this be happening? You know, how would we be able to see all these things? This sounds absolutely tremendous. Jesus emphasizes here, truly, listen to me now, truly I say to you, this generation is not going to pass away until all this happens. You got to believe that. People still today read this text, they do not want to believe it. They refuse to believe it. Even though Jesus stops and says, hang on, truly, this generation will still be around. They don't want to believe it. And we'll talk about some of the ways they try to get around it in just a second. But, you know, this is what this whole context has always been. You go back to the previous chapter, chapter 23, when he was indicting the Jewish teachers, and he told them in verse 35, on that generation, on you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar. Truly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. That's identical, isn't it? Identical. Same words. Now, he said that to the people when they were on the Temple Mount. And now when they have traveled to the Mount of Olives, he says it again. But the conversation, the subject matter is all the same. Judgment is coming. You know, God is going to avenge his righteous saints. He's going to avenge them in the judgment of the house of Israel in the first century. So, this generation. Now, I mentioned those involved in premillennialistic thought and their viewpoint of that fig tree, right? They think that's the Jewish race. Now, they get to this verse and they say, generation. Now, let's define that word generation. What does it really mean? And they say the word generation here is, in the original Greek, is genos, and it means race, kind, family, stock, or breed. I agree with that. I agree with the definition of genos is race. This is what I don't agree with. I don't agree with putting words in Jesus' mouth, because Jesus never used this word. Now, isn't that something? Arguing that these things haven't happened yet, because Jesus, he's speaking specifically and he's saying, oh, it's just the Jewish race won't pass away. You know, and all of this, it's clear. Jesus is giving timestamps throughout all this, right? And he's really solidifying time here. A bracket of time. And these folks come around and they say, oh, Jesus just means the race. The race won't pass away until these things take place. So, you know, these earthquakes or whatever, you know, the great tribulation, that's going to come, or it's happening now, or what have you. It's really shocking. It's unbelievable to me to put words in Jesus' mouth using this word genos, saying that Jesus is talking about the genos, the race of the Jews, not passing away till all these things take place. That's not the word that Jesus used. Look at any lexicon, you know, any Greek lexicon. Look at Matthew's account. Look at Mark 13's account of the Olivet Discourse. Look at Luke 21's account of the Olivet Discourse. You will not find genos anywhere. Or even what we just read in Matthew 23, where he said the same thing. This generation will not pass away. He did not use genos. In every occurrence, Jesus uses genia. They sound pretty similar, but they're completely different words. The definitions are entirely different. Genia is a step in a generation, in a genealogy, a single generation. How clear is that? And I get angry about this, you know. It's not what Jesus said. He's not talking about a race. He specifically said, genia, a step, one single generation. This one single generation will not pass away until all these things take place. And so no matter how fantastic we see these things in Matthew 24, we have to come back down to earth and revere the word of Christ, as he was very specific that all of this would occur in that step, the generation that those apostles lived, all right? These things would be occurring. Now again, that's very consistent, not just with the information given in the text and how it lines up perfectly with, you know, with history and what happened in the first century, but also Jesus' constant use to the apostles, personally putting them in these situations, saying, you're going to be there. You're going to be the one hated. Some of you are going to be the ones killed, you know, but this step in the genealogy of the world will not pass away, will not die until every last bit of this is accomplished. So Jesus is really very clear on this matter. And it's men who have muddied the waters here. And some of them flat out lied. And others, of course, are just perpetuating information that they've been told. And they think it's true. But go back to the lexicons, look at the words that Jesus uses, and you see that he is not referring to the Jewish race, but he is referring to one step, a single generation. Now, as we go on here to verse 35, he says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Look at that. This language doesn't get stronger than this, right? Something as permanent as heaven and earth passing away. It will pass away. He said, my words won't. And it shows how absolute his words are. Even though he's talking about things that haven't happened yet, he's speaking of them very specifically and very accurately. And then he lets them know, this is absolute. My words will not pass away. All the temporal things that you see will pass away, but my words will not. And so this is something that they could count on. Now, there's a flip side to this. I know I'm not going to be able to, I don't have time for it. But there is a flip side to this as well. And the way that Jesus uses the term heaven and earth passing away, and the way in which he used it on the Sermon on the Mount as well, and the way in which other scriptures use terminology like this, there is a great likelihood here that he's referring to the passing away of that old world, okay, and that covenant system passing away. Anyway, I wrote some things on that you can read about sometime if you're interested. But at any rate, in verse 36, he says, "But concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only." Now, when you look at a statement like this, we have a continuation here of thought in verse 36. And what has he been talking about but that they are to be looking and observing to see all these things happening? And when they do, he pointed out in verse 33, when you see all these things happening, you know he is near. All right? And so this is the day that I believe he's referring to in verse 36, the day and the hour when he's coming. So he's pointing out, you're going to know when he's near, okay, when the Son of Man is near for judgment upon the house of Israel in the first century in that generation. I've given you indications. I've told you about the abomination of desolation coming to surround Jerusalem. I've explained all these things to you, you know, he's saying, and so you know it's near, he says, but of the day and hour, that's a different story. I can't give you any information on that. And he points out, the reason I can't give you any information on that is because I don't even know. Only the Father in heaven. Now, there's a lot of interesting things here about this. You know, the word picture here is really explosive. The terminology that he's using, only the Father knows the day. In their culture, this was the idea of a marriage, all right, a wedding day. And the in their culture, no one knew the wedding day. The groom didn't know it. The bride didn't know it. Guess who knew? Only the father of the groom. Only the father of the groom knew the wedding day. Now, they had roughly a year or so to prepare. They knew it was coming. They knew it would be near. But they had no idea what day and what hour. In fact, it was very much so a surprise, kind of like a thief in the night. It was a surprise because it always happened at night, all right, when everybody was already sleeping. You know, knock, knock. You know, here comes the father of the groom knocking on the groom's door. Guess what? You're going to be married. It's tonight. It's this hour. And so he jumps up. And he's running around. He's shouting in the streets. You know, all of his friends and his companions, you know, they're waking up. They're gathering around. They've got their lamps. You know, it's interesting that here in just a moment, in the discourse here on the Mount of Olives, Jesus is going to talk about the parable of the wedding with the 10 virgins that, you know, 5 of them were prepared. They kept enough oil on hand. The other 5 didn't keep enough oil. And here comes the call of the bridegroom, right? And so all of this ties in, certainly. But, you know, it's a happy occasion. And that's one of the things that Jesus has been pointing out in this discourse, is that he's been talking about judgment, he's been talking about destruction, but whenever he talks to his apostles here, he says, your redemption is near. You know, for them it's pain, for them it's tribulation, but he'll tell them, your redemption is near. I believe he says that in Luke's account. You may have said it also in Matthew's. I think it's Luke's account, though. of the discourse. Your redemption is near. This is a happy day for you. You know, he talked about sealing off and gathering up the elect, you know, so that they are not condemned in this judgment. And so it was a happy day. It was a day of joy. It was a day of renewal. It was a day of restoration. The removal of the physical temple and the physical city of God was the greatest sigh of relief, you know, ever heard on planet Earth, you know, with in terms of the Christians. It was the end of a very long age of persecution for them by the hand of the Jews. And it was an end that solidified the true kingdom of God, that it was spiritual, that it was unshakable. And the shakable things in those days, they shook and they fell. And those things passed away. And what stood was unshakable. What stood was the spiritual kingdom of Christ. And so it's talked about in the scriptures as a wedding day. And there's lots of illustrations Revelation 19 is a really good illustration of that. Revelation 21, it talks about the church, you know, coming as a bride adorned for her husband. In those times of restoration, you have Paul talking to the Romans as well as to the Ephesians, and he paints that same picture that we're betrothed to Christ. Yeah. You know, but one of the interesting things is that in Romans and in Ephesians, Paul says we are betrothed, and he lets them know we are waiting for the wedding day. Hasn't happened yet. Not when he wrote Romans, not when he wrote Ephesians. Now, of course, all this is just an illustration. It's just figurative. But it is interesting that prior to the fall of the physical kingdom, we do have the apostles speaking of it as a betrothal ready for the wedding, ready for that day of joy, ready for that time of refreshing and rejoicing and restoration. And so here is, in verse 36, is a very iconic statement for their culture and understanding. The idea that you're not going to know the day or the hour, only the Father knows. And the apostles would have said, hey, I know what he's talking about. I know that word picture. You know, he's talking about the day of greatest joy for us. You know, he's painting the picture of a wedding day for us, but it's one that we've got to be prepared for. As everyone involved in the wedding party and all the guests invited to a wedding, they always had to be prepared, and they would wait because, like a thief in the night, they were going to be awoken to a loud sound of shouting in the streets. They'd have to grab their lamps because there are no lamps out in the streets. They'd have to grab their own oil lamp, and they'd run out and join the wedding procession. Now, here's some issues in verse 36. A lot of our brethren, I myself included, I used to teach that this is a transition text. Okay, that Jesus has been talking about things in the first century all this time, and now he's starting to transition. He's going to talk about the final day of judgment, you know, the end of the world, those kinds of things. I'll show you some of this in this lesson. I'm really disappointed in this kind of hermeneutic. It's not. I have some incredible concerns with it, and I've altogether dropped that idea. And hopefully you'll see why. You can examine the text for yourself. But remember, this is all about the original question of the apostles. And to put it in the simplest terms, I think Luke, you know, does it best. Luke's account of this discourse, chapter 21, verse 7, it says, they asked him, "Teacher, when will these things be?" Okay, remember he just said, oh, all these stones are going to be thrown down. He said, okay, well, when will these things be? And what will be the sign when these things are about to take place? See, the apostles, they have nothing in mind about the end of the world. Nothing at all in mind. That's not what they're inquiring. That's not their concern. Their concern is much more immediate. This is a completely different subject matter than the end of the world. And so it would be kind of strange for Jesus to now jump so far off of topic and now be talking about the end of the world. That's not what they asked him about. And it is evident as he continues that that's not what he's talking about either. He is staying in line with the context and the conversation about these things. When are these things about to take place? Notice he just told them, I can't tell you the day or the hour. I can tell you when it's near. I can give you some observations so that you can know when it's near. I'm not going to tell you the day or hour about when these things are about to take place. So that's what they had asked him about. And so this is not a transition. This is perfectly in line with what they were asking. When will these things take place? So verse 36, how could it be a transition when he's pointing out, I can't give you the day or the hour of when these things will take place? So now here's something. And this is how I used to argue it. I know others argued it as well. They say, well, look, notice the distinction between the terms that day and the term those days. If you notice in verse 36, he says concerning that day. And then those, you know, in that viewpoint, as I used to be, will say, look, earlier he was talking about those days. So there's a those days and there's a that day. Well, you know, to be rational about it, of course there were a those days and then there's a that day, right? Because there's those days leading up to showing you when it's near, and then there's a that day when it actually happens. So, you know, that's not a great argument. Look back here at this example. Earlier, in verse 17 of Matthew 24, he said, let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. He's talking about when the abomination came up against the holy place there in Jerusalem. And in verse 16, he said, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. This is a localized situation. This is a regional problem. And he said, verse 17, let the ones who is in the housetop not go down and take what's in the house. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days. Those days. Now again, I don't see an issue here between the those days leading up to that crack of judgment at the very end of it, all right, the end of those days, the end of the matter. And so we have those days leading up to that day. Well, the sign of the Son of Man in His power and in His glory in the heavens, reigning and judging and having all authority. So I don't see an issue. But, again, there are those who argue, as I was, that there's the those days, and that must be, whenever he talks about those days, it must be talking about the first century days, but that day, that's when he must be talking about the final day of judgment in the future. Again, I don't see how we can cut that distinction. Further, if you notice Luke's account of the situation, look how he just throws all this out the window. In Luke 17, 31, notice the same text we just talked about. In Matthew 24, you know, let those who are in the housetops, you know, not go down. Notice what Luke says. He says, on that day, let the one who is on the housetop with his goods in the house not come down to take them away. And likewise, let not the one who is in the field, you know, turn back. Isn't that interesting? And so this is part of the problem. When we're arguing for a transition text in Matthew 24, we're using only Matthew 24. And if you do, you could probably make something out of it. But if you looked at the entirety of what God has given to us about this information, we can't do it. And so trying to argue, well, there's the those days of the first century, and then there's the that day, the final day, but Luke doesn't make a distinction. He's talking about the first century. He's talking about the abomination of desolation coming, and he uses not the term those days like Matthew does. He uses the term that day. What do we do? What do we do with all this? It's not something you can hang your hat on. I don't think it really hold up to water. Let's go over to Luke's account. Luke chapter 21. We're going to look at some things in Luke 21 and then some things in Luke 17. In Luke 21, notice, this is exactly what we've been reading tonight from Matthew. And notice what Luke, how he points out the fact that this is not the final day of judgment, but life continues afterward. He says in verse 32, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all has taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But watch yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and cares of this life, and that day come upon you suddenly like a trap." Now, let's pause here for just a moment. Notice, we are on the back end of this event. And we are at the point that many are saying we've reached that transition. He's now talking about the final day of judgment, at least in Matthew's account. But notice, Luke's 21, he's still in the first century. He's telling the apostles personally, he says, watch yourselves. Watch yourselves that, in the middle of verse 34, that day doesn't come upon you suddenly like a trap. Come upon you that day. Which, if we're on the back end of the discourse, as I said, some are saying, as I used to, this is talking about the final day of judgment. But this day that he's still referring to in the context is a day that the apostles were alive and around still to see. So it doesn't look like he's jumped into the future at all. He's talking about that day coming upon them suddenly like a trap. They need to be ready for it. In verse 35, he says it's going to come upon all who dwell on the face of the earth. Don't think that just because you're in Judea or near Jerusalem, this is going to be a problem for you. That's not going to be a problem for you, rather. This is going to be a problem for you. It's going to be a problem for the whole world. I think that's evident from Revelation chapter 18 is a good example of the fall of the unfaithful city, Jerusalem, and how it affected the whole world. But probably not all that Jesus is referring to here. If we look back at our Bibles in Acts chapter 2, we see evidence that the Jews lived everywhere. Okay, they lived on the whole planet. Every nation under heaven, Acts 2 said. That's where the Jews resided. And so this judgment upon the Jews would certainly affect the entire world. In verse 36, he said, "But stay awake at all times, praying that you..." Okay, again, he's still talking personally to the apostles on the Mount of Olives. "That you may have strength to escape all these things that are going to take place and to stand before the Son of Man." And every day he was... Oh, I'm sorry. Let's stop right there. So, these things that are taking place so that you can stand before the Son of Man. Again, this was a judgment as Jesus was passing through the whole world. In fact, When Peter wrote his epistle, what did he say? He said, "Brethren, the hour is here. The hour is here. It's near. It's at the doors." He said, "For judgment to begin. And he says, and if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome of they who did not obey the gospel? Now again, Peter's actually writing in his epistle to the Jews who became Christians, right? He says, it's going to begin this judgment. The hour is here. He's not talking about a future final day of judgment, which there's going to be a future final day of judgment. Don't get me wrong. But God always rules. God always judges. God always puts down nations, whether it was Egypt or Assyria or Babylon or Rome or Judea. And so Peter, talking to the Jews who became Christians, he said, brethren, the hour is here. Judgment is to begin. It's to begin out the house of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome of those who do not obey the gospel? He's referring to those Jewish people who rejected the Lord, who pierced him, and they did not repent of their sins. What will be the outcome of they? So, so this idea of them standing before the Son of Man falls perfectly in line with the judgment. Not to be suspect that it was a final day of judgment. Now let's look over, lastly, at chapter 17 of Luke, and we'll see how all this falls into place. And this is really what challenged me more than anything and caused me to not just look at Matthew 24. You know, why was I doing that? When God gave me three witnesses, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, why did I look at all of them? Okay? And come to an understanding of truth from all three witnesses of these kinds of discussions that Jesus was having in those days. So in Luke 17, notice in verse 22, he said to his disciples, the days are coming when you will desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man. You will not see it. Now what we're about to read, you're going to remember from our previous lessons in Matthew 24. In verse 23, it says, and they will say to you, look there, look here. He says, do not go out or follow them. For as the lightning flashes and lights up the sky from one side to the other, so will the Son of Man be in his day. All right, this is almost word for word what we've looked at in the previous lessons on Matthew 24. He says in verse 25, but first he must suffer many things, be rejected by this generation, just as it was in the days of Noah, so will it be in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating and drinking and marrying and giving, being given in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, in the days of Lot, they were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But on the day when Lot went out from Sodom, fire and sulfur rained down from heaven, destroyed them all. So it will be on the day when the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, let no one who is on the housetop with his goods in the house not come down to take them away. Likewise, let not the one who is in the field not turn back. Remember Lot's wife? Whoever seeks to preserve his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life will keep it. I tell you, in that night, there will be two in one bed. One will be taken, the other left. There will be two women grinding together. One will be taken, the other left. And they said to him, where, Lord? And he said to them, where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Now this, all of this is in Matthew 24, except for Lot, okay? Lot and his wife. That's unique to Luke. But all of this is in Matthew 24. Some of it we haven't gotten to yet. Noah, all right, in Matthew 24, that's the next thing that's going to be dealt with is Noah. And what we have, try to give you the reference to that, verse 37 of Matthew 24. He's going to talk about Noah. Well, notice verse 37 comes after what? Verse 36, which we've been talking about, which again, many say that's a transition text to now talk about the end. And so now we're talking about Noah, or we're talking about two men being in the field, one taken, the other left, or two women grinding at the mill, one taken, the other left. All these discussions that come on the back end of the Olivet Discourse that many are saying, as I used to, This is the end of the world he's talking about. But when we get to Luke 17, what did we see? Luke 17 paired it all together in one perfect package, saying, this will be the times when the abomination came. He says, if you're on the housetop, don't go down, which we know he's not talking about the final day of judgment. The final day, why would we have to go down to get our luggage? If we're on the housetop, you flee, he was telling his apostles. Flee this judgment. Flee this destruction there in Judea. But amid all of this, we see him pairing the fleeing in those days to, he compares it to the days of Noah. He says there'll be two women grinding at the mill. There'll be two men in the field. One will be taken, the other left. We'll deal with that next week. The week after that, we'll have to deal with that. And what exactly that means. But you see all this together, it's one thing. Jesus talks about it as one thing, and not two separate events. And not one event in the first century and one event that still hasn't happened for us at some time in the future. It is all one thing we see here. When we look at all the accounts together, it is evident that Jesus is just talking about the judgment, the day in which he came in his glory and his kingdom to put away at last the physical kingdom of God, who had long been fruitless and had long rejected him. So, as I said, this was more of a technical lesson, and maybe not as enjoyable as some of the historical things we've been doing as we've gone through the Olivet Discourse. Nevertheless, this is necessary for us to move forward to understand what he's going to be talking about with the days of Noah and with one will be taken, the other left, those kinds of things. So, I appreciate your attention in this study tonight. And I certainly want to extend the gospel's invitation to anyone who is here this evening, who is yet to come unto the Lord. If you desire salvation in Christ Jesus and have faith in his name, then why don't you confess his name today, repent of your sins, and be baptized for the remission of your sins. If that describes your need, then why don't you please come.